coming up on this episode of Embracing Change with Lakrita Bowman and Jennifer Osborne.
You have a file on me with my name on it, but inside the file tells you what I've done, but it doesn't tell you who I am. And I don't remember a time anyone asking me, why do you do what you do? Why are you the way you are? And I said to the judge, and if you want to know, I hope you ask.
In chapter 6, which is called Hearing the Voice, you said you were in prison for the fifth time, and the difference in this one, there was a lot of things that were different, but mm-hmm. that you, the four before, mm-hmm. had been in Kentucky, and now you were in Ohio.
That was the big difference.
And you were not in a comfortable place. You couldn't just keep your head down and keep
Well, I had learned in Kentucky. See, I've been in Kentucky prison four times, so anything that is familiar, you know.
Right.
I had learned how to maneuver myself. And my friends were there. You know, from 18 all the way until I was 28 or 29, I was in and out of that prison. So we were all homies. So this time it was a different location, different state, different prison.
And there's a story in that chapter that I thought was interesting, in that it spoke a lot to the desperation of where you were. Mm-hmm. You had decided you were going to fake seizures so mm-hmm. that you could then get medicated so that you could just kind of sleep through your time.
Mm-hmm.
That says desperation in a big way. And in the story, I don't want to tell too much of your story, but it just...
Well, again, it talks about the lenses. Let's go back to that.
Yeah.
Pain has a lens. And so if I could change my reality, right? I had a 3 to 15 year sentence. It was the biggest, longest sentence I had ever been introduced to.
And the judge had told you were going to serve every day. So you knew you were in there.
Exactly.
Long haul.
Exactly. Which was a long time. And it was a different prison. So how do I maneuver? Well, I've always been creative. You know, and I've always been smart. I just wasn't using my intellect in a way to be healthy. It was always, how do I manipulate the situation I'm in and how do I tell the best stories? I if it was in a degree for liars, I'd probably got a master's degree.
Hmm.
I knew how to manipulate and I knew how to lie. I think some people just let me think I was the best liar. They knew I was lying. They just didn't. You know, we have a saying now that, why lie when the truth will do?
Yeah.
Well, when you believe the lie you're telling, that is your truth.
Yeah.
And so in that chapter, in that time, I had to come up with a way that I thought would get me out of my sentence. And so I felt like if I faked seizures, that maybe the judge would have some sympathy for me. The prison would not want to pay the cost of the hospital calls. And so maybe they would end up changing their minds.
Hmm.
That was really the motivation for the seizures. I was trying to get out of prison. And if I thought that that would help, then I did it.
It was by the grace of God, though, that story had
a okay ending.
An okay ending, because at some point, as you were faking these seizures...
Yeah, they overdosed me with medication that was not concurrent to the body that I had, and they were giving me medication for seizures that I wasn't having, and it created me to go into a coma. And I was on life support system.
Mm.
So again, the risk I was willing to take to try to change my reality could have killed me.
Yeah. Yeah. That.
And I believe that moment really is the trajectory that began to change my life, whether I knew it or not. That death experience, I think some out-of-body moment happened probably, and I wasn't... I've never said this before, but as I look back at probably, you know, that moment when I died for a couple of few minutes and they brought me back and put me on life support, there's something that possibly happened. I don't know what, but...
To wake you up? How do you mean that?
I mean that because that happened probably, I was in prison. That probably happened about March of 92. And so... By June of that same year, things begin to line up. So I don't know. I just, you know, and I've just said that for the first time today, that there probably was something in that moment that was a shift, a Kairos and Chronos moment, as I talked about it. That death brought life, and I just didn't know it until right now.
Yeah, that was like a really super low point, and I know it's been looked at like, wow, you really did this thing where you fake these seizures. And I know in your play Chameleon, it was given kind of a lighter look. But really, I mean, that was a desperate moment. For you to fake those seizures and to get on that medication, and then you die. But by the grace of God, you are alive today. And there was that shift. I mean, just the desperation in doing that because of everything that was surrounding that.
Yeah, but when you look back over my life, even when I was 12 and in the institution of Longview, and the shock treatments they gave us, and the Thorazine, and I shouldn't be in my right mind now. But the grace.
Yeah.
The grace.
God had a bigger plan.
His plan is always going to supersede our ego until it don't. You know what I mean? Because I know some people now that until it didn't, because death came, because they edged him out.
Yeah.
And they didn't trust him, and death came.
And it's tragic.
And it's tragic. So, and by the grace of God, that's why I'm so in love with him. And as best I know how. I love him as best I know how. And because I know that without him, I won't tell him where I'd be.
Oh, for all of us.
Yeah.
For all of us. It's really, it is the most profound thing when God takes us from our own plans and our own destructive ways, and he causes us to live, but not even live, to thrive.
Mm-hmm.
And he does it in ways that we couldn't even have done if we'd have planned it. You know what I mean? Because his ways are just
higher than ours and bigger and wider.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. He is just a really good God, a good, good father. Also in that chapter, there was a letter you had to write. And I know that it was probably, or I believe it was like 6 pages long or something along those lines, where you had to write a letter to the judge to explain to him why you should be let out. So what I want to talk about is when you were approaching that letter and you knew you had to actually sit down and write this, I think you had said one time some of it was not as sincere as others, but when you were approaching writing that letter, how did you get in the frame of mind to really begin to tell your story? Because I don't think you had ever told your story that way to someone to say, here's why I think I should be let out.
I have that letter now. I really didn't tell him why I should be let out. No. And I didn't approach it. Matter of fact, I refused to approach it because I wasn't going to beg him, as my lawyer asked me to do. I'm like, I'm not begging him to let me out. You know, again, the lens.
Yeah.
You know, because again, I didn't respect authority. So why would I beg authority to let me out? If, you know, all these years throughout all the incarcerations from the first one that I had when I was 12 and the judge left me there to all the other judges, why would I trust a judge? What would be my reasons? No, I'm not going to, you know, if you're going to file a motion, file it. But I'm not going to write a letter and ask him nothing. And so my lawyer kept saying, I can't file the motion without a letter from you, because your letter is a connection to that you desire it.
Gotcha.
And if you don't write the letter, then I can't file the motion. And so, and that took me about a month. It's the same way with the voice. It was something that pushed me. And I got up one night and I just began to write. And I tell people, I remind me of what Paul says. I don't know, John, he says it as well. I don't know if I was in the body or out of the body. I don't know. What, you know, in that frame of mind, when I wrote that letter, when I look at that letter now and I read it, I know that I would never have said that. And I didn't really tell him my story. I just said to him, you know, most of my life promises were made to be broken. And they were. So if you're looking for me to ask you or tell you, I promise you I will never do certain things again, I'm not going to tell you that. you have a file on me with my name on it. But inside the file tells you what I've done, but it doesn't tell you who I am. And I don't remember a time anyone asking me, why do you do what you do? Why are you the way you are? And I said to the judge, and if you want to know, I hope you ask. Because that file you have, it's not me. It's what I've done, but it's not who I am.
Did you fully understand who you were at that point?
No. And so in that moment, when I finished the letter, I said, but if someone would be willing to teach me to learn how to live, I think I'm ready. I want to learn. But I only say that if someone's willing. But if no one's willing, then how will I learn? And it reminds me of a scripture in Acts 8 when Philip is with the eunuch. And he said, how can a person learn unless they be taught? And he walked along that carriage with that eunuch for a while. And the eunuch was asking him all kinds of questions about the gospel. He told him about the book of Isaiah. I now look back over that and say, I was saying that. How can a person learn unless they be taught? I did not realize that that little girl had to be retaught how to live again. But again, I now know something bigger than me was making that moment happen. It wasn't me. I just was the person who I feel now had the opportunity and had the blessing. But it was the him in me that was pushing me. He was coming after me. But he really wasn't coming after me. He was coming after himself in me. And he needed to know. He still existed in me. And was I going to respond? And so I sent the letter. The judge said he had never been so compelled by a letter in his 33 years on the bench. And that with everyone's recommendation not to let me out, that for once he was going to say to me, and he did, you'll never be able to say that no one asked you why. I'm asking you why. And I said to him, because I'm in pain. And I don't want to keep living like this, but I don't know how not to. And that's when he said, well, I'm going to give you a chance to make a difference. If you come back in front of me, you're going to do every day plus whatever you come in. That was a week out is when I went to my probation officer.
Wow. That would have been a lot of super long, hard time.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you look back at it now, it might just be, you know, I've been out now since 92. This is 2020, so that's 28 years. I had a 15-year sentence, so you deduct that. I just might have been getting out 13 years ago.
So, it's interesting to think about where you would have been.
And then if I had more time on top of that.
If you'd have done something else, right? Right.
Yeah.
If you had not made the choices to make the changes.
Or to learn the changes.
Right. Well, being vulnerable to make those changes.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we don't want to be vulnerable enough to say, I don't know, or I've got to face this really painful thing that keeps causing me to react a certain way.
Yeah.
I mean, that's hard.
It is.
That's
still hard.
It's work. It's work. And depending on where you are in your life, you may not want to do the work or be willing to even jump into it, but you did.
And I still am.
And still are, right. Well, and that kind of goes into the next chapter, which is titled Scared But Determined. And the byline is The Process Begins.
Mm-hmm.
So this is when you're like really kind of jumping into things. And you talk about how you did that process. Mm-hmm. Aside from the vulnerability, you talked about there were specific things you had to put in your life to make going through that process stick, to make it stick. And one of the things you said is realizing that that change is a process and not instant.
Right.
And how, I guess that gets back to who we are as humans again, how we expect everything to be instant. And moving through that process. So for you, again, I know you said like we're all still processing, but that first big process, how was that moving through that when you accepted, okay, this is not going to be instant. I'm going to have to actually work at this a little bit. What did you do to kind of help that as you were progressing through it if someone else is trying to get through a change?
Well, I think that for me, I set new boundaries. See, I remember going into the Toppert house. I'll never forget it. And when I walked in there, it's a culture. Halfway houses, prisons, it's got its own little subculture. You know, we like to know stuff like, what you do? Why you here? You know what I mean? Because, again, it kind of helps you to avoid your own life. If I'm meddling in your life, right, then I don't have to look at mine. So I remember walking in, there's about 10 other women there, and I remember them asking me my name, and, you know, and I told them, and they was like, where you from? I told them where I was from, and they was like, what's your story? And I said, well, let me explain to you quickly what my story isn't. Not what my story is. I know how to do wrong all by myself. So I don't need your help to do that. If you want to help me get where I'm trying to go, then I'm all for it. But if you do something that's going to cause me to be in trouble at any level of this process, I'm going to tell on you. Because I know what it cost me to get here. And I refuse to not take my own self out. So if I'm not going to take me out, I ain't letting you take me out. And immediately it drew a line in the sand. Those women began, but I also knew it drew a level of accountability. Because that meant all 9 of those women were saying, who does she think she is? So then they were going to draw either a line to me to say, I can't wait to catch her. Or they were going to draw a line towards me and see that I was serious. So the fakers was going to leave me alone. The sincere people were going to join me. And I knew that. Because I know people. Even when I didn't really know myself. Because you got to realize, most of my life, I studied people from the outside. I was now getting ready to go into the classroom and study myself from the inside. Which was a difficult task. I knew how to deal with you. I just didn't know how to deal with me. So unless someone was willing to help me, I didn't need them to be a distraction to me. So that was the first line of approach. And then, of course, you know, throughout that process, I got introduced to the counselor, as I talked about earlier. Began to go to classes in Toppert House. Began to go to NA meetings. And realize more of, I was really not a drug addict as much as I was a pain addict. And when I say that, I mean that. I realized that if you smoke crack today, you're going to get the same experience that you would have for the first time. If you've never smoked crack or did any cocaine, that first high is all you're ever going to get. So after that, you're chasing an illusion. And that's what's making us crave it. Our endorphin means it's craving for the rush. And so I was more of a drug dealer, but I still had the addictive personality. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So NA, which is Narcotics Anonymous, helped me relate to that. It let me see that my story was different in the way that we all approached it, but yet it was still the same. My addiction to money and fast life and taking care of myself and surviving in the world led me to prison of 17 and a half years off and on, where someone else was smoking crack and it led them to do things they regretted, or they were alcoholic and it led them. So I don't think it's a difference. It's just the drug is different. And my drug was different, so I learned through NA to relate to what was mine. I didn't pick it apart and say, oh, that's not me. I looked at it and seen what was mine and how could I learn from it. So again, another process, another progression. Also looking at a counselor who saw something in me and invited me to church. Didn't really know God like that. Not really. Never seen anyone waiting in a line to get in church. I only seen people do that in concerts and bars. So to have that experience and be invited to a church at that point, and that was on the 29th day of November 1992. And I'm telling you, it was the best decision I made, because that's when the journey really began. I had all the other things that was happening, but then connecting to the Spirit of the Lord changed my life. I knew whatever those people were doing, and they were running around the church and acting crazy, I wanted what they had. And again, I had to be vulnerable enough to go up to the front and ask for it. And from there, went to different Bible studies and got connected and began to learn the Bible that I had read in the jail, that I didn't really know the stories, but I have such a great memory by the grace of God. It's another, I call it my superpower. It can be a curse and I'm telling you, it's a blessing and a curse. Yeah. But memory is a superpower of mine. I see things. When you give me words, I see pictures. So then it locks in my memory, and I can remember day and time, what I had on. They call it a photograph of memory. And so I'm really good at that. You know, I can go right back to the moment. That's why I can say it was the 29th day of, you know, November. I remember what I had on. I remember the moment. And the progression went, you know what I mean? And I remember the pastor who laid his hands on me said something to me. Most people, if you are familiar with the charismatic church, or, you know what I mean, the apostolic, and Christ Emmanuel had a bit of both. They were a Baptist church that came out of that, and Bishop Danley had a paradigm shift in his thinking and how, you know, the Lord had moved on his life through the Holy Spirit. He has a book out called Born Again. And so they had been moving into, so again, Kairos and Chronos. I just know that when he had been going through his changes, I may have been in prison, but I was coming. And so God knew it, and he was going to bring me to a place that I could almost grow with him in his change, from being a Baptist pastor to a non-denomination, charismatic, apostolic, non-denomination kind of person. So Bishop Dantley was going through his change, him and Pastor Curl, and here I come, I'm going through mine. And it just was that moment. And you had Pastor Benny Fluell in it. You had Sister Dolores. And you just had a whole group of people, Pastor Dale, and just Pastor John Sadell. You just, I mean, it was a dynamic group of people, gifted, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But I realized, I feel like God set the stage just for me. And so when I got there, you know, the progress, you know, the process started. And that's, you know, Bible studies, catechisms, you know, learning the Bible, understanding who I was, getting baptized, understanding to be dumped in the waters, to be identified from the old life to the new life. I was being washed, you know, just, oh my God. Whew. The progression, the process, consistently wanting it, willing to die to myself, willing to say, I don't know, willing to say, I want to grow up, and please somebody help me. All of it.
That please somebody help me brings me to another question about the process of inviting people in on that when you're going through it. Sounds to me like you had a church family that you had gone into. How did you create accountability in your change? Was it in the being truthful about where you were? Was it like opening up and just saying, here I am? And
yeah, it was. I think that they had a program called Adam. It was for, Christ Emmanuel was on the edge of something big. And I'm not saying they're not it now, but they were on the cutting edge to bringing church, psychology, and spirituality together. There was a woman there named Jerry Martin, who I ended up counseling with. And so then there, she had the natural and the spiritual, the psychology and the spiritual component. So there was a group called the Adam Group, called, and it was addicts, alcohol, drug, addiction, a ministry. So that spells Adam. And we would go to those meetings and we get to talk about God and our strongholds and, you know, and so that was a group of people that was, you know, that I was accountable to. Then from there, I got into counseling with Jerry Martin to a whole nother, after Nancy Smith Gosselin, there was another level of counseling I went into to try to be introduced to, you know, how do I bring this all together? How does, you know, Nancy was the psychologist and she dealt strictly with, you know, emotions, and then now Jerry's going to deal with the emotion and the spirit. And how, why do I think God allowed this to happen? How, you know, how does God work it together for my good? That process. So I think that there was pockets of accountability, and there was pockets of connections, whether they were close connections or not. They were enough for me to show up every Monday to Adam and every Wednesday to counseling, because I wanted something different. And I had had the good start in the beginning from Talbot House, if that makes sense. And then eventually, you know, we can probably talk about that in the next chapter. You know, I tell my testimony a couple of years later in Christ Emmanuel in 1995, March the 5th, 1995, I tell my testimony to the whole congregation.
Wow. Talk about an accountability. I mean, whole congregation.
I didn't even know I was going to. Someone else heard it, and they called me up there one night and said, we have someone. Again, I know it was God. We have someone in the midst that is a miracle, and we need to hear her story. And I didn't really know them like that. You know what I mean? Because I sat in the back, Bishop and them all in the front. I didn't really know them that way.
That took away the anonymity of it, too, because I know you talk a little bit about accountability needs to not be anonymous.
Exactly.
Because if you can be anonymous, then how can you be accountable?
Exactly.
So there you were in front of the whole church.
And back then, Christ Emmanuel probably had about 2,000 people.
Wow. That's a lot of accountability. Mm-hmm. Holy cow. Another thing you talk about in that whole process is honesty and not putting yourself in temptation. Mm-hmm. And how you have to make choices about, I can't put myself there because that is a temptation. And how you approach looking at your life and saying, okay, that's a weak spot for me, so I'm not going to go into that. And you talked about how you were ruthless in cutting out things in your life that you knew would trip you up, whether that was relationships with people and situations and...
Yeah, like, you know, I got a job. I think I talk about my job in that chapter, perhaps, when I went to Frisher's and got a job. And I, in my interview, I told him I was a thief, an ex-thief, and I was not going to put myself in that position to be tempted to steal their money because I didn't have any. So if I don't have it, I probably would be tempted to steal it. And he was just, Dave was so impressed by that. He was the interim manager. He was so impressed by that. He hired me, but he hired me as a host. And that was just to be able to say that without any shame, because I just knew that I had to be radical. And so I got the job, and it was like my first job that I had. You know, I probably had jobs here or there, but none that was, I was so proud of, like, oh my God, being honest works, right?
Yeah.
Being truthful, it doesn't hurt. It really helps. And I think it changed another lens, because before, as I had been honest, when I tried to tell my mom about my abuse, I got hurt. So it kind of began to change the trajectory and change the playing field. And so did that, and worked as a host for a while, and eventually got promoted as a cashier. You know, I cut people out of my life from my past, drew lines in the sand, couldn't be around them if they were doing things that were not conducive to my well-being, met new people. I think at that point I may have... By this time, probably had met my husband, you know. He comes in the line of, you know, after my job, and he pursued me with my friend. And I knew I didn't. I had lived in some homosexuality, but it was mainly out of my own lack of identity. And when in Rome, you do as the Romans. Being in prison, I was in prison with most girls. So we formed relationships, and I thought that was part of my identity and found out that it wasn't, as through my counseling and all those other things. And because I lacked nurturing from my mom at a very early age, and my very primitive development stages from birth to five is very, my mother was not, even the one who raised me was not a nurturer. She loved me, but she didn't nurture me. Mm. And so there's double lack of nurturing, the one who gave you away and then the one that was raising you.
Yeah.
So you're always looking for that woman to nurture you.
Yeah.
And so for me, homosexuality or the same-sex attraction became easy because I was looking for a woman to nurture me. And so working through all of that and just making some new decisions, setting some strong lines, boundaries, learning how to build fences until I could put a gate in it.
Which is good.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for taking us through these chapters. And listeners, there's going to be more to come as we continue on through the book. And thank you, Lucreta.
You're welcome.
It was great, great insight into a lot of different areas. So thank you.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to the Embracing Change podcast. Music production and mastering by Gone Coastal Productions. Podcast editing and production by Jennifer Osborne. Podcast copyright 2020 by Lucreta Bowman.